Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. On the night of January 21st, 1897, in Simpson County, Kentucky, a mob of white men gathered outside the house of a black farmer named George Dinning and accused him of stealing. They demanded that he and his family leave their property. Shots were fired, and after the dust settled, one white man was dead. Dinning fled for his life and turned himself in to authorities. Of course, stories of horrific violence committed against black Americans are not unique, but what makes this story different is that this man, George Dinning, was not lynched or imprisoned for murder. Though he was found guilty of manslaughter, the governor of Kentucky pardoned him, and with the help of a Confederate colonel-turned-lawyer, he was even able to successfully sue for damages. Dinning became the first black man in the South to win restitution from a mob that attempted to lynch him. Reporter and Pulitzer Prize finalist Ben Montgomery brings this little-known episode of American history to life in his new book, A Shot in the Moonlight, How a Freed Slave and a Confederate Soldier Fought for Justice in the Jim Crow South. And book clubbers, you might remember Ben from our Get Lit event with Colson Whitehead. Ben joined us to discuss his reporting on the Dozier School in Florida, which served as the inspiration for Whitehead's novel, The Nickel Boys. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Allison. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so glad you could come back to the show, and congratulations. This is a terrific book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I was just thinking about it earlier. Don't tell those boys at Radio Lab this, but yours is my favorite show on WNYC.
I won't tell. How did you first learn about George Dinning?
I had been working on a series for the Tampa Bay Times about police shootings in the state of Florida. And we were trying to take, it was a huge public records project. And we were trying to account for 6 years worth of police shootings. And, so as all these reports are coming in detailing specific shootings across the state, it just felt to me like so much tragedy. And, we would learn that out of the 830 some odd shootings that occurred over that 6 year period, about 40% of the victims of those shootings were black men. And so I found myself, because newspaper work is my day job and the book work is kind of, you know, what I do in the evenings, I found myself longing for a story that didn't end in tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so I took a deep plunge into the newspaper archives and just kind of fishing around for ideas, and came across the story of George Dinning, which was covered in, you know, papers across the country, including the New York Times. And it was a sensational case in its day. And when I learned more about the characters involved and sort of the historic record that existed, that made it 100 years later, I thought this is something that deserves, the proper treatment. It deserves to be one of those pieces of American civil rights history that we shouldn't be allowed to overlook or ignore.
Help us with time and place. What do we need to know? What's helpful to know about the political situation in Kentucky during this period?
Well, there was an interesting short-lived movement in state politics in a lot of places in the South that where progressive Republicans had taken office with the help of the black vote. And that was the case in Kentucky. Bill O'Bradley became governor and set about trying to, at the tail end of Reconstruction, set about trying to make things better for people of color in the state of Kentucky. And this this action, his pardoning of George Dinning, only 7 days after Dinning was convicted, was in keeping with what he did for much of his governorship.
Let's talk about George Dinning and the attack. So before the attack, what was George's life like? What was his reputation in the town?
Well, he had been born into slavery. Once he was emancipated, he had worked very hard to buy a piece of property, about 114 acres, from the man who had been his owner. David M. Denning, the man whose last name he took. And he set about farming that. He was a peaceful guy. There's no indication that he had any kind of criminal record. In fact, the sheriff in town knew George Denning, knew he had good character. That would be sullied in court during the criminal trial. All of his neighbors, in order to secure a conviction, would testify that he was a nefarious, no good guy. And this was pretty common. He got slandered in the press quite a bit as well. And ultimately, it didn't amount to much. I mean, he was convicted of manslaughter by an all-white jury, sentenced to 7 years prison. But as soon as he arrived at Eddyville, where the big state prison is in Kentucky, Western Kentucky, the governor pardoned him. And that's sort of, you know, you asked about time earlier. This was a time when lynchings were like clockwork. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a great amount of violence in the South. In fact, just 5 years before this event, the famous muckraking journalist Ida B. Wells had written in an editorial that the Winchester rifle deserves a place of honor in every black home to provide protection, which the law refuses to provide. And there's no telling whether George Denning knew that she had written that, but certainly he had a gun, and that gun provided him protection from his neighbors who had opened fire onto his little cabin.
Did you get a sense from the research? I mean, I got a sense from reading the book. Why do they want to run George off his property?
This is a very common thing in the South to drive people off. And it was all about theft of property. There's been modern reportage on that trend at the end of the 19th century and really before like the sustained civil rights movement of white people taking land from black people. It was a fairly common thing. And oftentimes the mob would be trying to send a message to other people of color in the area that it wasn't safe here for you. And so sometimes you see, if you look at census data, you see a strong and healthy black population in a certain county, and then one violent event. And then you look at the census data from the very next census that was taken, and the county is cleared out of people of color. So that seems to be the case. That land was coveted. It was fertile, 114 acres, beautiful farmland right on the banks of the Red River. And so there's no doubt in my mind the men who approached George Denning's house that night were not necessarily concerned about theft, but they were after his land.
What was George Denning's version of what happened that night? And then what did the men of the white mob say happened?
Well, Denning was... had a normal evening. He had chopped some firewood and started a fire and had some dinner and put his kids to bed. And about half of his 11 children were there with him that night. Some asleep upstairs, some downstairs with he and his wife. They woke when the dogs started barking out in the yard, and George went to the door, didn't open the door. He heard shouts coming from outside, men calling his name. He asked them to identify themselves, and they would not. They refused. They had disguised their voice. At least one of them had a cloth over his face to disguise himself. They demanded he come outside, and when he refused, this was when they began shooting into the house. And it's still unknown whether that was accidental or whether they actually fired into the house trying to hurt somebody. But he grabbed his own weapon, ran upstairs. As he ran past a window, he took a bullet in the arm. He made it upstairs, threw open the shutters, and leaned out. And as he did, he took a bullet in the forehead that just grazed his forehead, another inch, and he would be dead. But it grazed his forehead, and he leaned out just far enough to squeeze off one shot of his double-barreled shotgun. It was full of birdshot. It struck and killed the 32-year-old scion of the wealthiest farm family in southwestern Kentucky, a guy named Jody Kahn. What the men say, what they would testify to at trial, was that they were there in sort of a peacekeeping mission, that there had been some theft in the neighborhood, and they had been making the rounds to the suspected thieves' homes in order to encourage them to stop stealing. Now, never mind the fact that half of them were armed and that they had gone on this peacekeeping mission around midnight. This came up at trial as well. You know, that doesn't seem like you're just there to encourage people to stop stealing. That seems like, you know, to me, like you're up to no good. And in this case, that was, you know, they shot into his house. He was well within his right to defend himself.
My guest is Ben Montgomery. The name of his book is A Shot in the Moonlight, How a Freed Slave and a Confederate Soldier Fought for Justice in the Jim Crow South. We've said that he was convicted by a jury of white men of manslaughter. And then almost immediately, both black and white Kentuckians are asking the governor to pardon him. Some of the press got involved. There was this one open letter asking for the pardon saying, Dinning is a Negro. He is poor. He was a slave. He may be unworthy, but he is a citizen, a man, a husband, and a father. It was his home, and he was its defender. So enter Colonel Bennett Henderson Young, a former Confederate soldier, so much of a Confederate soldier that he tried to take over a town in Vermont, a small raid, which is bizarre. That's a whole other conversation. How do we understand Young? So here's this Confederate soldier who suddenly decides to engage with Dinning's case and take up his case.
Young was a true son of the South. He rode with Morgan's men, which, you know, that outfit made some of the deepest raids into, you know, north of the Mason-Dixon line. He spent some time in Camp Douglas, a prison outside of Chicago. Once he was out, he, like you said, he talked some, the Confederate hierarchy into allowing him, giving him permission to head up to Canada and to lead a raid into St. Albans, Vermont, which, you know, was the northernmost land action in the Civil War. So after the war ends, he's got to spend a couple of years in Europe before he's granted amnesty as an ex-Confederate officer. And so during this time, he gets a law degree. And by the time he returns to Louisville, he starts practicing law. And he's sort of a Renaissance man. He was an entrepreneur. He was a railroad builder. He built one of the bridges that spans the Ohio River in between Louisville and Indiana. He led the World's Fair when it came to Louisville. And on top of all this stuff, he begins to shape his life in a way that suggests to me that he had had some kind of a change of heart, that he took up you know, the causes of many men and women of color in federal court. He gave them helped them get access to the federal courts. He helped found an orphanage for black children. And during the rewriting of the Kentucky Constitution after the war, an effort that he led, he addressed slavery head on and said, you know, we as Southerners were wrong about this issue, and we recognize that now, and it's time to move forward. So the rest of his life, interestingly, is sort of balanced between helping men and women of color legally and otherwise. And, you know, and he was celebrated by lots of black clergymen at the time of his death in 1919. But in the last 20 years of his life, he also commits himself to forwarding the myth of the lost cause. And I don't think there's any contemporary man who did more than Bennett Young did to promote the idea that the Southern soldier was chivalrous and that he was fighting for states' rights, and that, you know, that Southern men of the Confederacy should be honored with, you know, with statuary in some cases. He raised money to build the Jefferson Davis Memorial, which, as far as I know, is the tallest, like, phallic memorial outside of the Washington Monument there in Western Kentucky. He delivered the keynote speeches at the unveilings of many Confederate statues, including one in downtown New Orleans. So he committed himself to these two things that seem very, very opposite, you know, in hindsight, both helping black men and women along in those tricky post-war years, and then also trying to preserve the myth of the lost cause.
He helped sue for damages, and Dinning was awarded $50,000. He didn't get close to that sum, but he did win some smaller cases a few times, one settled out of court. What did his case open for other Black Americans seeking justice for harm done to them?
Well, it gave people the notion that justice could be found in federal court, and that was not new when his case came along. A lot of Black men and women in the South sought justice and oftentimes retribution and revenge in federal court and were successful a lot of times. But I think what Denning's case did was it put on alert would-be lynch mobs, would-be white lynch mobs, that they could be held liable for the damage that they caused. And of course, those rewards for damages came because the mob returned to his home and set fire to his property. This is after the night when the shots were fired and after the night Jody Kahn was killed. They came the next day when Denning had turned himself into the sheriff, and they drove his wife and children off and then set fire to his house and his barn and his gear house and his fields. And so he had not, when he was pardoned, he had nothing to return to in southwestern Kentucky. And so he relocated his family across the Mason-Dixon line to Jeffersonville, Indiana. Mm-hmm. But those damages were awarded him because the mob had burned his house down. And this put, it's hard to measure the impact of a sensational story and a sensational verdict like that on future lynch mobs. But it certainly gave them the idea that they could be held liable for those damages if they did something similar.
The name of the book is A Shot in the Moonlight, How a Freed Slave and a Confederate Soldier Fought for Justice in the Jim Crow South. It's by Ben Montgomery. Ben, thank you so much for joining us once again.
It is my sincere pleasure. Thank you so much.